This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This summer or this fall, the Indiana General Assembly is going to be in session with a summer study session to take a look into the potential health benefits and decriminalization of THC products, which include marijuana, Delta 8 and Delta 9, may come up in the General Assembly in 2023. Let's get a historic perspective of the measure and of the topic itself about marijuana and legalization of it. Former State Senator Karen Talion from the Ogden Dunes, Portage area, is with us. And she's very well known for her concerns about marijuana and campaigning for marijuana legalization. And Karen, thank you for joining us today on the program.
Great, Chris. Glad to be here.
Will you give us a historic perspective, as I mentioned earlier, about the topic? And I guess now that we are getting close to the approach, at least of a study in the General Assembly of the issue.
Well, so a historic perspective could go all the way back to the 1920s, but I won't do that. Instead, we can just talk maybe about the last decade.
Okay.
Indiana and across the country. About 10, 11 years ago, I first proposed that we needed to do something about our marijuana laws in Indiana. Other states were already making it legal, of course, California, and then came Colorado. My major concern at that time was to stop putting people in jail. And I pushed very hard for decriminalization. Later, as the years went on, and I went through three governors with this, Mitch Daniels and Mike Pence and Eric Holcomb. And as the years went on, I tried different things. Let's study marijuana. Let's talk about decriminalization. Let's talk about medical use. And finally, I said, let's just legalize it. And none of those things happened. Every year there was some response, but not enough to get it on the agenda. So during those 10 years, by the way, the nation has moved towards marijuana reform in some way. There are only 10 states now that have done nothing, and Indiana's one of them. There are 19 states that are fully legal and taxing it. There are additional 8, 9, 10 states that have decriminalized. So we are now in the minority of states. I'm very happy to see that we finally got something, but in my opinion, it's very late and it's very little.
Do you think there's going to likely be anything in particular that may come out of the study committee? Since we know all they'll be able to do is issue recommendations, and the full General Assembly is going to be the one that will make a final decision, if any, on any measure that might come out of it.
Well, summer study committee recommendations are taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that. But unfortunately, and it's sort of strange, it was sent to the Health Committee. Now, right now, we have marijuana laws in three different sections of our code. We have it in criminal code, we have it in commerce, we have it in agriculture, but we don't have anything in health. This is a topic that needs to be broader than just one subcommittee. And so that's the biggest disappointment, is that we don't have a task force of some kind that's taking a broader look, not just at health, but at decriminalization. I mean, I know the people on those committees. The people on the health committees generally don't know much about criminal law.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that to put anybody, or about ag law. I'm not saying that to put anybody down. I'm just saying that it's a broad topic, and I had hoped it would have had a wider task force studying this.
Do you think that since it's going to a study committee that deals with health, that maybe all that we're going to find out, and maybe some in the recommendations it's liable to put out, is something that might change some of the statutes involving how marijuana is used for legal or for medical purposes?
Maybe. But again, it's still broader than that. There are farmers in Indiana growing agricultural hemp right now. That topic is still a mess, and is not, Indiana law, you know, across these various titles, is very inconsistent. Things aren't defined the same way everywhere. And, you know, if we do some little thing on medical marijuana, we will still be behind the times.
Well, I'll talk with your successor, State Senator Rodney Paul Jr., about this in a matter of moments to get his take on this. But I'm sure since he's closest to the issue right now, with his own personal stance, as he's mentioned, about decriminalizing and legalizing marijuana, I'm sure he's probably going to have something interesting to say about how this all breaks out, too.
Rodney and I have talked about this many times, because, you know, before I supported him for re-election, I wanted to know how he felt about certain issues that I'd been working on. So I don't think you'll find a big bunch of disagreement.
Well, Karen Talion, thank you for spending time with us talking with the historical perspective about the issues involving marijuana. And now that we know that the summer study committee is going to take up at least discussing the issue in some aspect or another, not maybe necessarily decriminalization, although who knows what's going to come out of the study committee recommendations. But it will be interesting to see what they do take up when they come back to Indianapolis later. Thank you for spending time with us to show your thoughts and share them with us.
All right. Good to talk to you, Chris.
That's a former state senator, Karen Talion. She's a practicing law in the Ogden Dunes area. Let's continue on with the conversation about what the summer and fall study committee is going to be taking up in the General Assembly concerning marijuana and related THC products. We're talking now with State Senator Rodney Paul Jr. from Northwest Indiana. In fact, he is the successor in that public office from Karen Talion, who we've just spoken to. Senator Paul, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Well, fill us in more that you've learned about what the summer study committee is going to be taking up, because I guess it focuses primarily on health issues, and we've talked with a former Senator Talion about that.
Yes. So it's my understanding it's been sent to the health committee. Had it been sent to the criminal corrections committee, the committee that I sit on, I think it would have been much more about, I believe the intent would have been for full-on on legalization. It appears that this is much more aimed towards a potential, you know, legalization for medicinal purposes. That's something that 37 states, you know, have already allowed, which is great. You know, I think that is a step in the right direction. It's better than not seeing a study done whatsoever. I think that the General Assembly and potentially the Republican Party is starting to kind of wake up to the issue that, hey, this is something that is happening. It's you know, seemingly inevitable. I've talked to actually law enforcement who believe, you know, it's inevitable, and that you know, they're already kind of in that mindset that it's coming down the pipeline. But as far as you know, as far as medicinal purposes, it's I think it's proven it's you know, medicinal marijuana is very useful, particularly for pain control, for nausea, you know, for you know, particularly for individuals, not necessarily for severe pain, but much more for like chronic pain, individuals that suffer from, you know, individuals that suffer from, I guess, pain problems that they cannot take Aleve or Advil or NASIDs. You know, people that have issues with kidney and ulcer problems or GERD or things like that.
So I suppose
I think it is a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I suppose too that for folks. People who suffer from issues, maybe that they're ones that might be ones that can be taken care of only to a point with medication, and it's I guess more for comfort, I guess, to help them be able to continue living for a while.
That's exactly, and I mean, and it's definitely a much better option than I think a lot of the pharmaceuticals that are out there. particularly those that, you know, rise to the level of opiates. You know, we've seen how terrible our opiate epidemic is, and a lot of it is, you know, a lot of it begins with individuals that are prescribed, pain relief that's opiate-based that ends up being habit-forming, you know, whereas marijuana is not seen as something that is as habit-forming or as habit-forming as opiates. There's definitely other uses, for example, multiple sclerosis, nerve pain. There are few, it's an area where few other options exist. And those that do, such as Nurotin and Lyrica and other opiates, are highly sedating. You know, so I think what you'll see is patients, they claim that marijuana allows them to resume their previous activities, without feeling completely out of it or disengaged. I think that those other substances, I think, are much more problematic, whereas, we're starting to see that there are these medicinal benefits that have just pretty much just been free for, decades and, up until just really recently, have just been pushed aside as, as not real. So.
Now, I know that study committee recommendations that are made after the work is done and sent on to the full General Assembly is oftentimes taken up as at least a serious matter that is worth developing a bill or bills out of. Do you think that might be the case, that if we don't have the strength in the medical law here in Indiana to include some of these things involving THC, that might change if the study committee recommends it?
I do. I think that's the intent. I think ultimately that's where you see a lot of your legislation that's a lot more comprehensive, and has the support. It starts with the study committee, a bipartisan effort that, individuals have all kind of at least set the stage for what they believe, the facts as they exist that they can all agree on, and what the legislation that exists or the potential for legislation that exists that they can all agree on. So I do think that this is a step in the right direction. It's not to the extent that I personally believe. I believe full legalization is probably much mm-hmm. more effective, but and has much more benefits. And you and I discussed that in a previous regionally speaking episode. But yeah, I mean, I do think that at least this is a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you felt that if this was sort of a baby step that the lawmakers feel comfortable in taking rather than trying to deal with the legalization and decriminalization issue right away.
Potentially. I do think that it's definitely something that, I think had there been, there had been a... the want to do so with full legalization, it would have gone probably to the corrections committee, as I stated before. I do think that though that having it go to health, they're at least serious about studying what are the beneficial uses of it other than just full legalization. And I think that's for the time being, I think that is where Indiana is probably at as far as the supermajority stands. So.
State Senator Rodney Paul Jr. is from Northwest Indiana, and thank you for being with us to talk about your thoughts concerning what the Summer Study Committee is going to take up and looking into the potential health benefits of THC, including marijuana, and some of the other products that are out there, and that might lead to some changes in the Indiana medical law that will benefit Hoosiers in general. Thank you for being with us to talk about it.
Yeah, no problem.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Life along the Kankakee and the Yellow Rivers are both so closely blended together from one county to the other that residents don't always recognize they're separate rivers, but the problems along those rivers are all the same. They're very common. And the Kankakee River Basin and the Yellow River Basin Development Commission is responsible for water resource planning and development on the rivers that all run through Lake, Porter, Newton, Jasper, and LaPorte counties, and also counties to the east of our area. And to talk more about the commission and some of the work that is still being done. It's not all been done. A lot of it is historical work, but the up-to-the-date work is still planned. And we have with us Scott Pelath, who's the executive director of the commissions. The long name is the Kankakee River Basin and Yellow River Basin Development Commission. And it's a very small group, I understand, that do an awful lot of work to help keep things from flooding, or try to keep things from flooding here in the region, don't they, Scott?
That's correct. And Chris, it's good to be with you.
Thank you, and
thanks for patiently stating our name. It can be a real real mouthful. A lot of times we just call ourselves the Basin Development Commission. We've been around for a few years now, and people have sort of gotten used to the the shorthand.
Mm-hmm. For people that are not familiar with the particular organization, talk about, if you will, and about the importance of keeping track of these two historic but very important rivers.
A couple of key factors. First of all, we have to remember that the Kankakee River is one of the most unique bodies of water in the United States. In Indiana, it was once over 200 miles long, and now it's about 75 miles long. And that's because over 100 years ago, it was dredged and straightened in order to uncover some of the world's most productive farm ground for our agricultural economy. But there's been a lot of consequences to that, which we're dealing with to this day, in particular flood mitigation challenges. And that is one reason that the commission was created. The other reason that the legislature sort of initiated and executed the idea of forming this commission was that parochialism only works for solids. Mm-hmm. it works just fine when things stay in their place. But water, it's a bit cliche to say, runs downhill. And what benefits a county with respect to flood mitigation is often resources and efforts that are made in a different county, either upstream from there or downstream from there. And that really amplifies the need for close coordination. And I'm gratified that we have a very committed group of 9 members, which includes one member from each of the 8 counties that we serve, appointed by the respective county commissioners, and a 9th voting member that represents the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. They've been a pleasure to work for. And I can personally attest that every day they're thinking of how they can improve conditions, not just economically, but also environmentally here in this region.
I know that going back to history, the part of the Northwest Indiana history that interests most people the most about the Kankakee River was what was there. Like you said, the river got straightened out, and before mm-hmm. it was meandering and was much, much longer than it is now. But all of the farmland was created because of all the flooding that had happened over the years past. And I know a lot of that obviously has changed to a point, but we're still very concerned about flooding on certainly the Kankakee River.
That's correct. And they'll be debating what was done 100 years ago for generations in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the reality. It was done. There are some benefits that came from that. You had a very successful agribusiness sector. You had communities, historic ones sometimes, that were established on that ground. You have people and residences. And you have the economic benefits of those things. So the question now becomes, given that was done, how do we preserve the economic importance of those areas? But also, instead of fighting nature so much, how do we work with it? And how do we restore some of what was there while maintaining much of what is there in order to live in concert with this unique body of water? And that's part of what makes our mission very complex, but it's also part of what makes it very invigorating to pursue.
Has it been a case where, as you mentioned, trying to kind of preserve the past, that is the fact that things have been straightened out and everything has changed, but still trying to preserve the history of the fact that the river is so still very pretty, even during the flood stages, it's still a very pretty sight. And people, of course, that can travel closest to the river, that is, for example, if they go on I-65 over the Kankakee River, or they go over U.S. 41 there in the Schneider area, and they get to see the river, it gets very pretty, even though it's kind of scary when the river levels up. But just the same, people are very interested, almost intrigued by the river.
You would be amazed by the degree of expertise of the history of the Kankakee River that exists among people who live and farm near it. The neat thing is some of the goals of the commission, some of our broader goals, they seem like they're mutually exclusive, but they're not. And I'll give you some examples. One interest that is shared both by the agricultural community, the environmental community, a diverse group of stakeholders, is how do we prevent erosion? How do we improve our water quality? Well, on one hand, we want better water quality. We want less suspended sediment. We want less erosion on both channels. But we also rely on that too for basic flood control reasons. because that sand that enters the channel makes it hard to control and manage increasing amounts of water over time. So that's something the commission has targeted. What do we do about erosion? Well, we learned that 40% of what is suspended sediment in the Kankakee River actually originates in the Yellow River. So that's what we're doing first, is stabilizing those sand dune banks of the Yellow River in order to improve the environmental quality of the Kankakee, but also to include its flood mitigation capacity. Another thing we can do along the banks of the Kankakee River, sometimes you'll see banks simply sliding in. It's all carried downstream into Illinois. You know, it'll happen up maybe in St. Joseph County. It winds up in Lake County. Well, you can do a better job at seeding and stabilizing those banks with native grasses, for instance. Sometimes wetland restoration is important. We're doing that right now in Newton County. We have a farm that the commission owns. It's being converted into an area that flood water can flow into. Now, you get a couple of benefits from that. One, you get the environmental restoration of that area, but additionally, you're having the water be in that place instead of somewhere else. You can't live with it. So they sometimes seem like competing aims, but they're not. And that's what the commission does, is bring those different interests into harmony.
You mentioned at the outset of the conversation about the fact that the commission is made up of representatives from all eight of the counties that share the rivers, Yellow and the Kankakee rivers. What kind of cooperation do you get from the highway department crews in helping get the cleanup that needs to be done? And as you mentioned, to trying to stabilize the sandbanks, since everything's flowing downriver and eventually into Illinois.
The cooperation we have from counties is terrific. I couldn't give more praise, not just to the financial support that they will give to the commission, but in terms of the time that they dedicate. And I'll give a perfect example, Porter County and Lake County. We sometimes have bridges that jam up with debris during flood conditions. Well, that's exactly when you don't want that to happen. Mm-hmm. When you're having a flood, you want the water to move downstream its normal course. But we have these human-made barriers that will impede that. And very frequently, we'll get into those conditions. All you have to do is make one coordinating phone call, and it's not long before a highway department is out there removing those barriers. The commission is doing the same thing at the same time. We have these things up and down the Kankakee and Yellow River channels, and we work together. The good news is really easy to work together because we have a clearly shared interest.
Mm-hmm. Is it a case that the public really sees all these people at work when we have a flood condition or maybe impending flood conditions? We get the alerts from the National Weather Service in Chicago about how the rain situation is going to be. We get the flood warnings or the flood advisories that come in. And so we know that the rivers are going to rise, mm-hmm. if they haven't already, by the time some of the alerts go out, I'm sure. But it's just a case where the public doesn't see that until they get to this situation where there's so much water that it has to be dealt with.
That's true, and in fairness, I can't necessarily expect them to be paying attention, right. Although many do. Before those warnings come out, we're watching river conditions very closely, and we also understand that just because it's flooding in one area doesn't mean it's flooding at another yet. That water moves downstream. We'll have perhaps flood conditions up in Plymouth and Marshall County, and we won't see those flood conditions down in Lake County until several days later. Mm-hmm. So that gives us some time to prepare. You have to have an understanding of how the river tends to behave, because that helps in your flood response planning process.
Speaking of the plans, I know that in presentations that you make, in fact, one you mentioned that you made recently to the Lake County Soil and Water Conservation people about how the commission's working. You have plans for work that'll be underway this summer, and I'm sure probably into the fall as long as the weather provides. Tell us a little bit about some of the areas that for 2022. You're going to focus on, or the commission's going to focus on, rather, and the crews will be able to start doing to be able to deal with some of the problems and make some improvements.
A couple of things that I should mention specific to that. First is that as soon as the commission was formed in 2019, it adopted a 40-year work plan, which was developed with state investment from Indiana, but also from Illinois, because there are partners across the border. It recommends that we do several things. One is stabilize the banks of the Kankakee River so we don't have breaches, you know, at peak flood events. It recommends that we limit erosion with a focus on the Yellow River in order to maintain the channel capacity that we already have. It suggests that we look for areas that can store and contain flood water without adverse impact to others. It drives us to develop formal flood response plans. We do all of these things every day. But you have to break these long-term plans into digestible segments from year to year.
Right.
This year, we are reconstructing another mile of stream bank on the Yellow River in Stark County. That's going to be a major project, about $1.65 million. It's slated to begin in May, and we hope it will be done late summer or early this fall. It's our expectation that we will be doing one of these projects every year for the next several years in order to really begin to see the difference and the reduction in sediment from that particular tributary. Every year, we also look for ways to stabilize banks on the Kankakee River. Sometimes that is through very remedial measures, but this year we're going to be doing substantial amounts of reseeding with native grasses to make sure that those banks hold in place. What I'm most excited about this year, though, is we're going to be able to manageably reconnect the floodplain to the Kankakee River. So when we get flood events, we know that the water is going into a manageable area and it's not going to be spilling over the bank somewhere else. We've got a couple of areas in Jasper County that we're doing the design work for. I mentioned the one in Newton County. We're also looking for a place further upstream. This is hundreds of acres at a time that can hold flood water during peak events, and you know it's not running onto someone else's farm because it's there instead. And 2022 stands to be a very exciting and fulfilling year for progress along the Kankakee.
Now, if there's anybody that is interested in finding out more, not only about the commission, but keeping track of these projects as they start to develop through the year, how can they find out more now?
Well, I would urge them to visit our website at kankakeeandyellowrivers.org, and on there they can find, you know, the boring stuff like meeting minutes and maybe how to get in touch with some of the members. But they will also find drone footage, for instance, of the Kankakee and Yellow Rivers, where they can get a before and after perspective. They can see some of the latest news, and they can also tune in there for flood warning and forecasting.
Scott Pilath is Executive Director of the Kankakee River Basin and Yellow River Basin Development Commission. You know, both rivers we all keep a very close eye on when the weather gets bad, as it's starting to do since it's spring. And thank you very much for spending time explaining things and giving us at least a preview of what kind of work is going to be continuing on the rivers, especially as the water flows from the east to the west and eventually into Illinois. Thanks very much for being with us to talk about it today, Scott.
Thanks so much, Chris. Great to be with you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. On Tuesday, May 24th, we were all tuned in as news of yet another mass school shooting came down. During a time when students should be preparing to enjoy summer vacations and relaxation, we are now all faced with helping youth navigate this latest crisis. Lakeshore Public Radio's Dee Dotson recently spoke with Laura Wynn, who founded Indiana Parenting Institute as a parenting and family management resource for parents with children birth through 18 years, challenged by the complexities of raising children today, especially in the context of keeping children safe and thriving. Laura provided tips and tools to help parents support children, as well as process the state of emotional health of our youth today. Here's a conversation.
Earlier this week, we were all tuned into the news as reports came down to yet another mass school shooting. Reactions from around the world were filled with outrage. School shootings have made a lot of parents anxious. Parents are more often worried about it than younger kids are, but kids pick up on their parents' fears. And parents worry that seeing news reports of school shootings may be harming their kids. We're turning now to Laura Wynn with Indiana Parenting Institute to learn how parents can help children navigate through this latest crisis. Laura, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me. And I do want to extend my condolences to the families. I cannot even imagine what they must be going through at this time. It's very difficult to just have a child injured, but to have a child go through that level of crisis is just, it's just heartbreaking, actually.
Laura, your organization was founded to help parents navigate the unique challenges of raising kids. Mm-hmm. Earlier this week, we learned of a school mass shooting where an 18-year-old male, armed with a rifle and a handgun, shot his grandmother before driving to an elementary school in Texas. Once he was able to gain entry into the school, the gunman opened fire in a classroom, killing 19 young students as well as two teachers. Your organization, the Indiana Parenting Institute, has worked primarily with trauma-impacted families throughout Northwest Indiana. If contacted by a parent that may be concerned with how to parent their child through this latest crisis, what would you offer?
First of all, I think that it's very important for parents to understand that children do go through trauma. Parents go through trauma as adults, and we're very much aware of that. And sometimes with children, we try to brush it off like, it's not that important. They're just a kid. They're going to get over it, right? But something this traumatic, there is a lot of nurturing required. By nurturing, I mean absolutely paying attention, absolutely listening to what the child has to say, how the child is feeling, dealing with those feelings that the child has. This is a time to be very attentive to your children, to give them all the hugs that they need as they go through this, let them process it, help them process it, and just be there as a point of support. And don't, shut it down and say, let's not talk about it, let's move on, because that is not actually addressing the issue. That is just, sweeping it under the carpet, but it still impacts the feelings of the child. So I think that it's really very important for parents to be engaged, to be attentive, to understand the process of grief. And for parents who've not dealt with child grief before, it's important that they find out how to address that particular issue. By that, I mean to read more, to just be more understanding of children. They may have nightmares. Give them lots of hugs and lots of assurances.
For parents, teachers, and school administrators, how can schools respond and help students process this tragedy? Should children's access to news or social media be limited at this time? And at what level do you recommend parents even broach the subject?
I think that it's important for kids to be aware of what's going on in the society in which they live. And I think everything is age appropriate. They're, for kids, the age of the students, of these students, they're already, through social media, already is aware of the things that are going on within our society. I don't think that it's that you should keep it from them, but definitely be there to talk to them in a way to explain that these are absolutely isolated incidents. It don't happen in every school. Why it happened at this particular school is because the child, the 18-year-old, was obviously going through a lot of social, emotional issues himself that were not being addressed, perhaps within the structure of the family. Most incidents like this that happen, my first thought is always, what was the child that committed this act going through in their own homes? What kind of parenting was that child receiving? What happened? Mm-hmm. Sometimes parents don't realize the impact that they have on the social or emotional development of children. And we are not cautious in terms of the things that we say to them. So for this particular situation, I do think that it's important for parents to not necessarily allow children to listen to the media. But the question is, how do you prevent it? because they all are walking around with cell phones. Do you know what I mean? So it's easy for them to access that information. Yeah. But I would certainly help them process that information.
And what about parents, Laura? How can they process this for themselves? You know, earlier you alluded to, you know, we all have concerns with processing things. How can parents process this? Should they seek support and resources like those offered through IPI in order to help equip them to support their children?
I think that it's really important for parents. Parents sometimes have a very difficult time thinking about counseling, thinking about going in and talking to professionals about such traumatic situations as this. They'll say, I don't need it. I'm going to say again that one of the things about grief, I always refer to grief as a silent killer, more or less, meaning that unless you address the issue, unless you talk to somebody about it, you know, unless you seek to get the understanding of why did this happen. A lot of parents will even start blaming themselves. I shouldn't have sent my kid to this school. I shouldn't have done this. I shouldn't have done that. It's important for parents as well as children, as well as teachers, and probably even elements of people in the community to begin to look at reaching out to others who can help, like an Indiana Parenting Institute, like a social worker, like a counselor, like your minister, so that you get a better sense of self in this whole process. You know, how do you process that?
And finally, Laura, the only word that I can use to describe the events that unfolded earlier this week inside a school in Texas is trauma. Every morning, many parents practice the tried and true ritual of sending their kids off to school, but for the parents of those precious 19 young students, they didn't come home. Now, even though the most recent mass school shooting did not happen here in the Hoosier State, how can community members support families during such a sad time in our country's history?
I would say be there for them. Let people know that you understand the tragedy that they're going through. Trauma is definitely something that stays with you. It becomes a part of you. There's no way for any of those parents of those children to ever forget that this incident occurred. So the best way to process it, like I said, is talk about it. Don't talk about it necessarily in a negative light, but talk about it in terms of how do we move forward? How do we heal from this? Who do we need to talk to move through this process? That's how I would recommend parents come in and talk to somebody. Don't be afraid. Don't think, I need help, because a lot of parents are very reluctant. I said that earlier, to get help. This is one of those situations where you need to reach out. You need to talk to somebody that you trust, that have the experience and the knowledge to help you work through it. I mean, it's a family issue to me. It's not just an individual issue. If you are part of a family, everybody in your household that went to that school is affected by that process. So everybody, the family, the mother, the father, the other children, should be a part of that process to get the help that they need.
Laura Nguyen is a certified parent educator and the founder and chief executive officer of Indiana Parenting Institute, headquartered in Gary, Indiana. Laura, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
I really appreciate the opportunity. And again, my heart goes out to the families. And if there's anything we can do for anyone within our community, please do not hesitate to reach out to us. We are here to help, to serve the community. And we can be reached at Indiana Parenting Institute. Our telephone number is 219-886-1111. And we are here for you.
This is Lakeshore Public Radio's Dee Dotson speaking with Indiana Parenting Institute founder and chief executive officer, Laura Nguyen. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. And we'll be back with you tomorrow.